Earthworm Evasion of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Alien Worms, Killer Caramel, Divorcing the Pope, and an interview with Tony Sobrato about constructing the theory about conspiracy theories. Let's begin episode 157.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are away from the cosmos to know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we've traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Dawn, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. You know, Ethan, I listen to a lot of podcasts and weird things on the internet, and I came across what I think is just the most weirdest thing ever. There are a number of things that we think of sort of ubiquitous in the natural environment. Trees, bees, birds, and earthworms. There's a problem here. Apparently one of those elements is unnatural. To be placed in the unbelievable things that I have learned, I have to add, in Canada and northern United States, there is no such thing as a natural or indigenous earthworm. Now, I have to pull back a little bit on the hyperbole. Actually, areas along the Pacific coast that escaped glaciation do have worms that are indigenous, but it looks like all the local worms died in the last major ice age. Now, of course, you might say, Dawn, you're daft. I see birds munching on earthworms every rainy day. Sometimes the sidewalk is just caked with them. How do I explain all these if they went extinct in the last ice age? Well, apparently, it's along with the other plagues that Western settlers brought to this country, earthworms were one of them. Seems that the little buggers stowed away in the ballast of ships, plants we imported, and actually the European settlers brought them on purpose because they thought that it was needed for a healthy garden and crops. So all the earthworms, or almost all the earthworms you see apparently in Canada, are European immigrants, just like you and me, Ethan.
Wow, that's humbling in some ways.
Again, it's one of those things, I mean, you don't think about it. You just assume, you know, everything has been here forever. It's like when Native Americans, you know, like they've been here forever. No, they're immigrants too. They came a lot later than we did. But most things that are in North America and South America even are actually immigrants from Asia.
True. And I wonder what it was like the first time somebody who, you know, maybe a Native American first saw an earthworm and was like, holy crap, what the hell is that thing? Because they're really weird looking. And the first time you see a worm, like I don't remember the first time I saw a worm. I think I was probably too young to remember. But even every now and then I'll be walking down the street after, you know, a rainstorm, and happens frequently here in Vancouver, and I'll see a worm and I'll be like, you know, damn, that's a really ugly animal.
Well, you know, and they must think coming up from the ground, they're all wiggly and squiggly, and they probably would have seen things like maggots, and they probably thought that this was some sort of evil death thing that was coming from the ground, some sort of monster maybe.
It is possible.
Actually, you know, it's funny. We do kind of have a way of judging how the first natives may have noticed this, or even perhaps in the north, apparently there was this big, huge kerfuffle about 5 or 6 years ago when they discovered this funny thing flying around that had these weird markings. Apparently they had concentric yellow and black rings around it. And apparently it was like the first time on the Baffin Island or something like that, they had ever seen a bee. And it was like this really weird thing, and they were all freaked out by it.
Well, I'm freaked out when I see bees.
Well, understandably, they're out to get you.
They're little buggers, I mean. But let's move on, because we got a great show today. We have a really interesting interview coming up later on. But before we get to all that, we really need to discuss why Coke and Pepsi have decided not to kill us.
Right, Ethan. So it seems that Coke and Pepsi, among others, have apparently been feeding us cancer-causing chemicals in the guise of caramel coloring for years. Now, this came to my attention because there's currently a lawsuit going on based on a California consumer advocacy law passed in 1986. The aim of this law is to protect state residents from chemicals known to cause cancer, birth defects, or other reproductive harm and to inform citizens about exposure to such chemicals. The law works kind of weirdly, though. A citizen can petition to have a chemical, in this case it's a chemical, placed on a banned or restricted list. Now, this law works differently than we normally would think, in that one mechanism of enforcement is via a lawsuit brought on by a private party acting in the public interest. In this case, the Center for Science and the Public Interest is suing so that the beverage makers must abide by the government guidelines. Apparently, the caramel coloring that makes Coke look like Pepsi contains a chemical called 4-methylimedazole, 4-MEI for short. The California environmental guidelines say that a can should only contain 29 milligrams of this chemical. A recent sample done by the Center for Science and Public Interest showed cans containing as much as 153 micrograms. It's quite a bit over the limit. The guidelines, though, are regarded as being overly tight, ergo why there hasn't been any enforcement by the government agencies themselves. I suspect the political deadlock is the reason why the limit itself hasn't been changed. California is quite famous for its partisan politics, but to be fair, my research hasn't uncovered that particular quandary itself. What I did find out was that the original research that caused M4EI to be listed as a carcinogen in the first place. The study done, I think around 2006, showed that this chemical is linked to some types of cancer in rats at doses as low as 15 milligrams per kilo. This would work out to be about 1.3 grams for the average person. Of course, if you do the math, one has to wonder if this might be a case of being overly cautious. Now, I acknowledge that our biochemist is off on sabbatical, so my take on this might be slightly off, but here goes. Now, the study lasted for over 2 years, at which time the rats involved were dissected for cancer and other medical conditions. It was discovered that the rats that consumed 15 milligrams a day were adversely affected, i.e., that was the level that it was dangerous to ingest. If we convert this amount to cans of Coke, we find the rats were drinking roughly 98 cans a day. Now, the numbers that have been bantered around on the internet by groups like the FDA or the American Beverage Association, and the Beverage Association is a lobbyist group for the Cokes and Pepsis of the world, so I'm a little dubious of their things, but they were actually posting numbers of almost 3,000 cans a day being the amount these rats were ingesting. Now, this is true, but it misses one point. The study was using variable doses on different groups of rats and a control group which didn't have any at all. Now, the largest amount that any of these groups were given worked out to be the 3,000 cans a day number. However, the numbers that I used, the 98 cans a day, was the minimal amount needed to show some effect. Regardless of which numbers you use, though, it still seems like a lot of pop to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, this doesn't actually surprise me too much. I remember one time I was in the Los Angeles airport, and I was sort of falling asleep in the waiting room, and I was awoken by someone sitting next to me who pointed my attention to a sign that said, caution, there could be carcinogenic chemicals around. And they were a little concerned about this, and I kind of thought, well, we're in an airport, there's bound to be, you know, trace amounts of whatever going around. So honestly, I agree that the caution is always important, but at a certain point, I mean, if we're talking about drinking 98 cans of pop a day, I don't know if I need to be told that's a bad idea.
I haven't had that much pop in one day for, well, weeks.
Yeah, exactly, right? And I mean, this could go to back to sort of a sort of common criticism that I have when it comes to, you know, concerns about nutrition, but also concerns about, you know, what chemicals you're ingesting is, well, in what context are we talking about that ingestion of chemicals, right? I'm reminded of that movie, that Super Size Me movie, where the guy ate McDonald's like three times a day for I don't know how long he did it, and got like sick and depressed and all those things, which is, you know, a valid result. But keep in mind, he's eating McDonald's all the time, and he was overeating as well. And I occasionally have a can of pop, as I'm sure most of our listeners do. But, you know, I'm not going to drink 98 cans a day. And honestly, if I'm consuming something that much, even if I imagine that if I ate 98 bananas a day, I'm sure there's going to be some negative consequence to sort of overeating or overconsuming a product. And I'm sure that every product has got to have some cancer-causing chemical. I mean, everything causes cancer, doesn't it? I mean, I don't know. Seems a little too cautious.
And on this point, perhaps the reason why I wanted to bring this to attention is the whole idea that, I mean, I'm glad this particular group is keeping their eye on this issue. It is good because, although in this case, you know, I think they're overblowing it, you need to keep an eye on it. But when you use a sort of a false flag on this, when there really is an issue that needs to be dealt with, everyone says, oh, yes, you've cried wolf so many times before, it doesn't mean anything. For example, right now, and again, I might be having to eat my words in the future, but right now there's a whole worry about radiation in Fukushima in Japan. But actually, most studies have been shown that more people are dying from the stress about worrying about the radiation than will likely ever die from the radiation itself. In fact, a lot of the studies that I've seen have said that, you know, people who live in Denver are getting more radiation just naturally than the people that would live around the exclusion zone and Fukushima. And where that comes into be a problem is when it does come time for us to say, listen, this regulatory measure needs to be improved because there's this real risk. Everyone's going to say, oh, yes, but you said that about this and nothing ever happened, or you said it about that and it was proven to be wrong. It weakens future attempts to actually put forward good regulations and good controls over things that really will cause us harm.
Absolutely. And no one, in my opinion, should ever say, you know, oh, I told you so, you're just making a mountain out of a molehill. When it comes to public health, I think it's a very important issue. It's public health. And we should be aware that, yes, drinking 98 cans of pop may give you cancer. That's a good thing to know. And it certainly wouldn't hurt to probably reduce that chemical a little bit. So, I mean, we shouldn't be too negative about concerns like this, but at the same time, we do have to be a bit skeptical and think critically about, well, you know, are we creating a hassle? Are we creating something that's going to drain our resources when we could be better focused on perhaps a more serious public health menace, perhaps cigarette smoke or, you know, smog, for example? We really, I think, need to pick our battles a bit better, perhaps.
I don't think I would disagree with you. And in fact, one of the things where they could be spending some more time is in the area of women's health, and in particular, the huge debate from out of nowhere that's come on in the United States, where the Catholic Church and actually other religious groups are trying to harm women by preventing them from getting contraception.
In fact, that controversial move by the Catholic Church may lose them a few members. We'll get onto that story right after this commercial break here on Radio Freethinker.
Hello, this is Tony Sobrado, social scientist and theorist on conspiracy theories. You are listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR Radio 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia.
And we're back here on Radio Freethinker. So as we hinted at before the break, there is a lot of controversy going on in the United States with regards to the Catholic Church, which is kind of an oxymoron because when is there not controversy going on with the Catholic Church? But today, secular groups are fighting back, so to speak. The organization Freedom From Religion Foundation has placed an open letter, a full-page ad, in the New York Times urging people to quit the Catholic Church over its war on contraception. The ad begins with, quote, "It's your moment of truth. Do you choose women and their rights or bishops and their wrongs? You are an enabler, and it's got to stop." So this brand new ad put out by the Freedom From Religious Foundation is actually based on a letter that the co-president Ann Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker wrote, and it appears in a full-page ad in the New York Times urging people to quit the Catholic Church. It's pretty bold, and you can go online, of course, and see the ad out there. It includes a political cartoon where you have a sort of angry bishop, a picture of a birth control pill and a woman. The bishop says, "All the outrage over something this small," pointing towards the birth control pill, followed by the woman saying, "Is a bit hard to swallow." So it's, I think, a very interesting ad because this is coming, of course, from a different perspective than we traditionally see with, you know, atheist banners atheist billboards that we've been talking about in the past. This is focusing on a very specific issue, birth control, women's rights, and it's a pretty direct statement, not just to non-believers, but Catholic liberals who, let's face it, they're out there, to stand up and say, hey, wait a second, you know, I shouldn't be a member of this organization that has this amount of disrespect for a woman's right to make a decision about her own body.
Yeah, no, I think I would agree. In fact, it's one of those things in my political science hat that a lot of pundits in the United States are sitting back and they're scratching their head really about the whole, is this really where you want to put your flag? Because this seems like such an issue, everyone's going to lose. And I mean, the studies that I've heard that in their lifetime, about 98% of Catholics have used contraception at one point or another. Well, the crux of this whole issue is that they had posed a law in the United States that would force health insurers to provide contraception to the employees of a company. Now, of course, this originally was supposed to be paid for by your employer, which, of course, the Catholic Church said, listen, that would mean we would be paying for contraception for women, and that goes against our religious beliefs. So they actually wrote in an exception that for religious institutions, they do not have to pay, but the health provider, so Mutual of Omaha, whatever, they would pay for the contraception. So the women would still get their free contraception, while the church didn't actually technically have to pay for it.
Well, speaking of paying for it, I mean, this is obviously an expensive ad to run the New York Times. It's, you know, one of the most famous newspapers in the world. The Freedom From Religious Foundation actually you had to raise $52,000. And you think, oh my goodness, that's a huge amount of money. That must have taken them a really long time. It took them a week to raise this amount of money. That is extraordinary. And what I really admire about this is that they said, okay, to their members, listen, we want to run this ad in the New York Times. This is what it's going to say. This is what it's going to contain. And this is what we need. And it was a very clear, it was a very concise, perfectly laid out goal. And everyone knew exactly what they were donating to get this goal done. And people stepped up and they got it done. And I think that's a wonderful statement for the sometimes, fracturous skeptical movement that we're able to say, look, here's our objective. You know, here's our goal. Here's what we need, what we're going to do. Let's get it done. And they got it done in a week. And they put up this amazing ad. And the great thing about this, I think, is that not that I'm, stepping away from the hardcore new atheist stuff, but this ad is not necessarily an atheist ad. If you look really closely, it doesn't say anything that's, radically offensive to a religious person. It's really, I think, directed at more sort of the liberal, kind of non-confrontational religious person. Maybe the person who kind of marginally believes in God but doesn't necessarily go to church every day. And I think that's a very important demographic that this organization is reaching right now. And, to me, that achieves a really key objective. They're reaching a demographic that traditionally we have trouble reaching. And it's not out there to say, hey, atheists, you're not alone. It's not out there to say we exist. It's out there to talk directly to the people that we need to win over to our side. And that's a great objective to have. And it's not the only objective out there, of course. Some groups will have different ones, and those are perfectly valid as well. But I really admire the fact that they set out to achieve an objective and achieved it perfectly. And, I mean, good on them for doing this. It's really quite great. And, of course, at the bottom of the ad is a Freedom From Religious Foundation voucher thing where you can cut it out of the New York Times and mail in a donation, become a member of the organization. And again, what a great idea. What a way to track your ad. You know, see how many cutouts from the New York Times get mailed to you and think, wow, we did a really good thing. I'm really hopeful that, they'll make back the amount of money they spent on the ad and membership and fundraising for this. I think a really great idea.
You know, on the one hand, I'm going to agree with you, and I think I've said before, although I consider myself sort of to be more of the in-your-face, asshole-ish type atheist, that you need to have a team, and that it's good that there are some people who are sort of the soft sellers of reason and rationality, and this is exactly what this is directed at, bullying on Frit. But now to go on with atheists and skeptics tend to be a contentious crowd, there's actually two parts of this that I didn't like about it. Now, one line they sit there and they say, and I'm quoting from the article, the church that hasn't persuaded you to shun contraception now wants to use the force of secular law to deny birth control to non-Catholics. Now, the reasoning behind this is that if you happen to be a non-Catholic and you're working for, like, the Christian TV station, they would not have to pay for your birth control. But that does strike me as being different than saying you cannot have birth control. There's been a bit of conflating on both sides about how this will be the end of legal contraception in the United States. And that's a bit of a red flag. I mean, I agree with the economic argument that if I can't afford birth control, that is the same as denying me birth control. But it isn't actually making birth control illegal. And a lot of the discussion around this implies that if it doesn't outright say that. And the other thing, and I'll let Ethan comment after, is the part that you like, the little send us some money part, I don't know, that kind of cheapened it a little bit for me. I think become a member was good, but the whole standard donation makes this somehow seem like we're not trying to rescue people from the Catholic Church. This is like, hey, this is a way for us to make some money and market ourselves. And that kind of cheapened it for me. I understand why they did it, but it cheapened it for me.
Yeah, I didn't feel the same way about the membership thing at the bottom, obviously. I mean, I know from a lot of experience how the free thought movement organizes itself. And I know how difficult it is for the free thought movement to raise money. Even what might be considered a small amount, like $52,000. And again, like it's just one of those things that is a necessity that these organizations seem to be funded, because there's just no way they can do what they do without it. And given the fact that the organizations that we typically run up against, whether it's the Catholic Church or, you know, a Sylvia Brown or whatever, these people have funding that we could just never hope to match. So we really need to take every opportunity to, you know, for lack of a better word, pimp our products and hustle ourselves and put, you know, a constant plea for we need your support. So I'm not terribly concerned about that aspect. With regards to the other question about sort of the legal ramifications of this, obviously the Catholic Church isn't necessarily suggesting that they're going to make contraception illegal, but they are certainly using their clout to make it extremely difficult to get it, and at the very least, They are certainly violating the rights to access of healthcare to people to get this. And I think that's just as bad as trying to make it illegal. They're trying to make it impossible to get. So, yeah, I mean, there certainly are issues that you could take maybe like minor quibbles with the ad itself. It's certainly not going to please everything, which again, and that's what I said, it's not meant to. It's meant to be an ad for a very specific purpose, or to a very specific audience, and again, a perfectly valid approach to dealing with this, and I think they succeeded quite well. So the other reason why I think this ad is really important is because the Catholic Church is again in the news, especially in America. There was a big controversy when the Pope came forward to denounce the, quote, powerful political and cultural currents Seeking to legalize gay marriage in the United States. Maryland had recently become the 8th state to allow gay marriage. Now, I mean, as a skeptical podcast, a humanist podcast that promotes civil liberties and science and critical thinking, you know, obviously our stance is this is, you know, an abomination, and this is, hideously bigotry by the Catholic Church. But I think it is kind of interesting that the Pope has gone on to suggest that the legalization of gay marriage poses such a significant risk to, you know, the traditional family. And he had an interesting quote where he mentions how traditional marriage had to be defended because whatever injured families injured societies. Well, I thought, well, that's not a bad point, actually, because, I mean, society is made up of families, of course, and if something injures the family, then it could injure society. Now, however, I think the Pope dropped the ball because I thought of a few other things that injure families. For example, stealing babies, I think, injures families. I don't think that would be really beneficial to society either. So maybe the Pope should also, you know, mention that's not a good thing either. Raping children also strikes me as not beneficial for families. I think that would be very devastating for a family to have to go through that. So he probably should also make a point of mentioning that's not to be to be done anymore as well. And then, of course, you have, you know, things like denying contraception to families that need it because of economic reasons. That could put a terrible strain on a family to have to deal with that. And then, of course, there's things like, you know, discouraging the use of condoms to places that are dealing with an AIDS epidemic. I think that would be kind of damaging to society as well. So I could go on, but I'm sure the, you know, I know these press releases are kind of expensive, and I think the Vatican is a little stretched for cash, so I don't know if they had enough, you know, room to write all these things down, but maybe on their webpage they'll post something.
True. Maybe they need a little divine help in that area. Although, I have to wonder if maybe somewhere in this is the Freedom From Religion Foundation is plotting some sort of conspiracy in order to take over the Vatican to forward some sort of alien plan to rule the world. We'll find out more about this and other kinds of conspiracies when we come back and we have our interview with Tony Sobrato, and we talk about kinds of conspiracies and how to put a framework into discussing them after this commercial.
Any UBC student knows that the year begins optimistically.
In your arms tonight.
But by the end of it, you're ready for a little. Any smart UBC student will therefore know that it's best to get your tickets early to the annual AMS Block Party, featuring Mother Mother, Mastercraft, DJ Headspin, the Boom Booms, and more. Thursday, April 5th on the McInnes Field, your AMS brings you the fifth year of music, partying, and hopefully some sunshine. Early bird tickets available at the Outpost until March 9th, and general tickets available thereafter. For more info, search for the AMS Block Party on Facebook. The fifth annual AMS Block Party is proudly sponsored by CITR.
And this is Don, Radio Free Thinker. Just remind you, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. If you have any questions, comments, or queries, please email us at info@radiofreethinker or check out our blog and website at www.radiofreethinker.com.
UBC Bookstore is having a student appreciation sale March 14th. Their way of saying thanks for all your support this past academic year. There will be snacks, DJs, and karaoke. Oh yeah, and discounts too. 25% off giftware, clothing, and stationery, 10% off computer accessories, and 20% off all general books. Visit the main store from 9:30 a.m. to 6 p.m. or the solder store from 10 to 5. UBC Bookstore, where your purchases support your UBC campus.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you sweet deals on the West Side and UBC area at Banyan Books, The Bike Kitchen, Displaced Hasheries, The Eatery, Fresh is the Best Salsa, Gumdrops, Illusion Studio and Spa, Kerner's Pub, Prussian Music, Rufus's Guitar Shop, and West Coast Music.
And don't forget the UBC Bookstore. It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or visit us online at citr.ca.
Hello, listeners. I'd like to welcome to the show Tony Sobrato. Tony is a research analyst and social scientist currently based in London, author of the soon-to-be-published book, Who Rules the World? An Analysis of Conspiracy Theory. He also contributes to the Huffington Post. Hello, Tony. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Don. It's a pleasure to be here. Hello, everyone listening in Vancouver and Canada.
You come to us today to help solve some of the greatest mysteries of humanity. Why are we attracted to conspiracy theories? Are they all the same? And how do we analyze them? I guess my first question to you is going to be, are we as a species predisposed, at least socially, to see conspiracies around every corner?
Well, this is an interesting question. I mean, it depends primarily on basic human cognition, and this is in terms of observing social and natural phenomena. So the human mind is predisposed to observe phenomena, and that means we need to explain them in some form or another. Now, historically and teleologically over history, we've seen these forms of social and natural explanations evolve in themselves. So in antiquity, it was usually done by mythological explanation and theological explanations. And obviously, we've got the ancient classic societies that used to espouse a number of different gods that all were using the explanation of both social and natural events. So obviously, we've got the god of war, the god of love, and the god of nature. We also saw this explanation in primitive tribal societies that espouse more supernatural elements. So disease, illness, death, and social retribution was often explained by the supernatural powers of invisible agents, such as witches, evil, and satanic forces. Now, what you have to understand here is, without the introduction of the scientific method, which is basically proposing a theory and then testifying it with some method, it's not hard to see how in old tribal communities, mishaps and misfortunes would have been explained by some form of agency, either within your tribe or your group, or an external agent. So, for example, something bad happens to you, a loved one may have died, so you don't know if they've died of disease, you don't know if they've been murdered. Obviously, in primal tribes, there is no forensic evidence being investigated here. So what humans primarily do, and research in neuroscience shows us, that we need agency as a form of explanation. So here we have the first premise, the interception, if you will, the introduction of an agent that is responsible for some sort of a social phenomenon. So conspiratorially, it could have been that these people got together and killed my child. That's one agent form of it. Or another agent form of explanation would be it was a supernatural element, that it was a witch or some evil force explained. So in terms of pure cognition, I think using conspiracy theories, although certain conspiracy theories do exist, and I'll talk about this later, there is a predisposed schema, a resonance, if you like, of a tribal tribe that we still need some form of conspiracy theories to explain social phenomena without, obviously, in its context, there was no complex forms of social understanding or no theoretical laws of physics to explain natural events, and obviously no social sciences yet to explain complex interaction. So conspiracy theories are cognitively embedded as a way to explain phenomena, and unfortunately people still employ them to this day.
An evolutionary psychologist might contend that a predilection to see conspiracies could be an evolutionary advantage. I mean, if I perceive a plot or conspiracy to attack my clan or village by supposed hostile enemies, there are three possible outcomes. One, I prepare a defense, but there's no attack, so I am out some resources, but I'm prepared for a potential future attack. Two, I prepare a defense, and there is an attack, but damage to my people has been minimized. Or three, I don't prepare a defense, and there's an attack, my whole clan or village is wiped out, disaster. It would seem those who are prone to see threats, real or otherwise, would have this evolutionary advantage, at least for primitive cultures and when they're not supernatural threats. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, that's completely true. And it depends how you divide conspiracy theories. And these are why they're used in primitive and modern days of social explanation, because primarily, which I'll discuss, single-point conspiracy theories do exist, which is a collection of human agents come together by certain means with certain goals and agendas to basically overcome you or a group in a certain way. So as you're saying there, with pre-tribal warfare, it is possible, and a realistic explanation could be, that another group is trying to usurp your group for whatever reasons, resources, food, or land. That's where conspiracy theories, A, are useful, and to a certain extent can be true. That's one reason why they've lasted so long through human evolution, because in terms of explanation, sometimes they can be correct. On the other side, in terms of mystique, not having acquired knowledge, and ignorance, they're unfortunately still used to explain all kinds of different social phenomena when we don't really need them anymore to be useful in explanations. And obviously, for example, we no longer use supernatural agents to explain why someone's ill, and we no longer use supernatural agents to explain phenomena in nature, such as waterfalls, natural disasters. But as you say in there, one reason why conspiracy theories still have such salience today is because they are, at times, valid forms of explanations.
probably weren't aware of this, but my last interview was with Liu Igwe, and we were talking about witch hunters in Africa, where they were literally putting supernatural agencies behind deaths and all that sort of thing. So sadly, there are still parts of the world where that is happening. It's quite interesting. On the show, when we approach conspiracy theories, we tend to sort of have a two-part process. One, do the facts on the ground support the claim? And two, if they do, does this actually imply the conspiracy claimed? Often we find that the facts are outright falsehoods or contorted interpretations. However, some do seem to point to a smoking gun, sort of. However, most of those fail to be the big conspiracy sort of thing. You know, in an Occam razor way, you can usually find some other explanation. Most often, I tend to find they are what I call natural faux-spiracies. That is, it's not really a conspiracy, it's just the way nature sort of works. Like in capitalism, you know, the fact that corporations will all tend to want to control the price and raise the price isn't necessarily some huge plot, it's just in their nature to do in a too free market sort of capitalist society. However, from what I read about your approach, our sort of one-size-fits-all style may not be that appropriate. From what I understand, if we are to truly understand conspiracies, we need to have sort of a theory, a framework onto which to place it. Tell us about your project. Well, why did you do it in the first place?
I read social science, or mainly political science and aspects of social psychology as an undergraduate, so I've always been interested in a certain political phenomena, and then following my master's degree, I was also interested in conspiracy theories, and this is a few years after 9/11. So it's kind of a passionate understanding of politics and current affairs, but also kind of understanding what it is about conspiracy theories and why they have such a massive appeal in the modern world. And as a child growing up, as we can all relate to, obviously, the big JFK conspiracy theories, there's the conspiracy theories about Pearl Harbor and the Second World War, there's conspiracy theories about whether Hitler died or not. And this was kind of brought to fruition with the massive show in the 90s, The X-Files, where kind of conspiracy theories went mainstream. So from my perspective, obviously, it's kind of a mixture of academia and general interest. And what I've been doing with my research is breaking down the different types of conspiracy theories. And one reason why one size fits all is not a very good way to understand conspiracy theories in terms of both the people that espouse them and people like us that try to investigate and understand them is that they're so complex in terms of what they're trying to kind of advocate that you have to break them down differently to see which kind of conspiracy theories are plausible and then distinguish them from the ones that aren't plausible. Now, this applies to certain phenomena, say you say 9/11, which is basically you can take any kind of evidence and facts and then twist them in a way that makes it look logical and plausible. This can happen to any discourse and any phenomenon, and everyone does it in social explanations. Now, what I advocate with single point conspiracy theories, and that's kind of alluding to the point that you were making with tribal warfare and explaining warfare as the consequences of agents wanting to usurp people. This is a single point of conspiracy theory in terms of it's independent to its own social and historical context. And these are the kind of conspiracy theories that are plausible and are potentially true. Another perfect example of this is obviously Julius Caesar, who was actually murdered by a single point conspiracy, the famous Brutus incident. So he was brought down by people that no longer wanted him in the Senate. Now, these are single point conspiracy theories that, if they occur, they are independent to their social and historical context and nothing else. For example, if you're an advocate of the JFK conspiracy theory, then the most plausible explanation behind that in terms of a single point conspiracy theory is that it was other agents, apart from Lee Harvey Oswald, whether it was the Cuban Castro affiliations or the mafia, that were involved in assassinating the president. Nothing more. Okay, it's a form of vile corruption, but it could happen as a single point of conspiracy theory. What this then entails is then when these kind of single point conspiracy theories become embellished and elaborated to what we call meta conspiracy theories, which are that the conspiracy theory, the incident or the phenomena observed, is tied into a grander and overarching conspiracy theory. And this is really causes problems for the people that advocate them, because off the bat they sound completely rational and like lunatics, when really what they should be doing with a conspiracy theory is focusing on one conspiracy theory and not how it's overarched to a meta-conspiracy theory. So prime examples of this are, say, JFK, 9/11, the murder of John Paul II. They're all operated by the same shadowy cabal, such as the Illuminati and the New World Order, for reasons to take over the world. Now, these are the kind of meta-conspiracy theories that are less plausible. Now, what happens with these conspiracy theories over single-point conspiracy theories, which are plausible, is that they become evolved and embellished in themselves. And what happens is, where it's hard to basically justify such complex social phenomena in terms of it's all being coming back to a single source, like a secret society that's basically running history behind a closed door over, say, hundreds and possibly thousands of years, that everything's kind of intricately linked like a pattern, where these kind of explanations start to sound bizarre in themselves in terms of social phenomena, these conspiracy theories evolve into transcendental and metaphysical conspiracy theories, because you now have to leave the realm of everyday social natural explanation and you have to propose other agencies or form of agencies that are responsible for this. And this is where we see the classic case of someone like David Icke, which is no longer operating in the social world. He's dealing with shape-shifting aliens, forms of higher consciousness that are responsible for this grand historical conspiracy theory, or also conservative right-wing conspiracy theories which believe it's all the work of the devil. And these kind of conspiracy theories have to leave the social realm, because if they're going to explain historically over hundreds and possibly thousands of years how each incident in history is controlled by one agency or force, then it's not likely in terms of everyday social explanation that it's going to be one group. It has to be a more powerful group. And thus we see such agencies as shape-shifting aliens or the devil coming into the picture. So this is kind of the issue that makes conspiracy theories more complex, because when you study a conspiracy theory, you have to see whether it's a single point of conspiracy theory or a meta-conspiracy theory. And this is kind of the work I've been doing in terms of basically breaking down different types of conspiracy theory and seeing where their complexities arise. If I may also just make a point here as well, which is to do with terminology. Now, I agree with you completely in terms of saying that corporations that maximize profit under a capitalist paradigm has nothing to do with a conspiracy theory, and I agree with that. That's just one way of looking at the social world. So a meta-conspiracy theorist, someone like, say, Alex Jones or David Icke, would propose that it's all kind of part of the bigger plan, the bigger picture, whether it's the Illuminati or the New World Order. Then you could have a Marxist argument saying that, no, this has nothing to do with a meta-conspiracy theory. It's just how the economic base constantly determines social and political activity. And that's one way of looking at the free market economics and corporations. Another way you can analyze it is by, instead of looking at constant conspiracies used in explanation, you can look at terms of corruption and unaccountable democratic electability. So one work that I've been doing recently with Dr. Ian Richardson, who's the author of the Bilderberg Group Elite Consensus, is a very interesting area, because we look at the Bilderberg Group not in terms of it's basically a collection of the world's most rich and powerful people behind a closed door making decisions about how they're going to control the world. It's more to do with issues of unelectable accountability, because these people sit outside governments and basically make decisions that affect the world. And now this can be explained in terms of elite theory and social science. At the same time, conspiracy theorists kind of get shoehorned in through the back door and are like, well, this is part of a meta-conspiracy theory to rule the world. So this is the kind of the complexity you're dealing with when you're looking at these phenomena and how conspiracy theories are used to explain them. And that's really why I've been breaking down the model in terms of single point conspiracy theories, meta-conspiracy theories, and also using the social sciences to explain conspiracy theories.
Okay, we're going to take a bit of a break. When we come back, we'll continue our interview with Tony Sobrato.
Hello, this is Leo Iwe, Nigerian skeptic, global humanist, and a tireless proponent of rational compassion in the global community. Help promote skepticism and rational thinking by listening to CITR Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, Canada. Rational compassion is all about our applying our reason to help humanity, to help enlighten the world.
Welcome back. So, Tony, One thing I've noticed, and what we were discussing before the break, is people didn't have a fuzzy idea about what qualifies as a conspiracy. How would you define a conspiracy in the context of your framework?
Well, if you look at the standard definition of conspiracy, it's an act between more than one agent to elicit some kind of response in a social phenomena, usually hidden, so it's outside of public view. That's kind of a loose understanding of conspiracy. And conspiracies do happen, as we know. I mean, they happen in social situations. I mean, just as a trivial point, you could be going out somewhere with your friends tonight and you've got one club that you want to go to, or one bar or one theatre, and everyone's agreed to do that. And then you turn up and you find out that that theatre or that club or that bar apparently isn't showing the show that you wanted to watch. Then you later find out that two of your friends only said that to you because they wanted to go to another theatre. Technically, in social terms and linguistic terms, they have conspired against you. But that is not the same as a meta-conspiracy theory or political conspiracy theory, which basically states straight off the bat that what you perceive as social, political, and economic reality is merely an illusion, and what agents are behind this phenomena aren't visible. That's what qualifies a conspiracy theory in this context.
You've talked about the connection between postmodernist thinking and conspiracy theorist mind, in particular deconstructionist theory, that in a world that seems to make little sense to these people, there is a rejection of all the, quote, established truth, thus allowing them, subconsciously I'm sure, to interpret data, and I use data here because facts for them don't really have the same meaning it would for you and I, but allows them to interpret the data to support some overarching conspiracy that will explain sort of the dystopian state of the world that they perceive. Is my explanation right? How does this gain us insight into the theorist's mind, and what does it say about the validity of their claims?
This is a very interesting point. In terms of, I look at conspiracy theories also in terms of philosophy of science and philosophy of social science, so it's the use and validity of facts. Now, this ties in two ways. In terms of the postmodern tradition, there is no such thing as universal or external truth. Everything is up for grabs under a discourse. Now, if you look at the famous philosopher Jacques Derrida and deconstruction theory, which is there is any phenomena is open to unlimited forms of interpretation. And we see this happen all the time, every day, under any phenomenon. So if you think about the origin and the present state of the universe, there are basically more or less in a crude way of breaking this form down, there are two alternative views to this. One is that it's so improbable that all the laws of physics came together to make a visible cosmos and make life on Earth, yet so improbable, yet it's possible, and we're here by pure chance. Now, there's another school of thought that looks at the exact same evidence and the exact same facts and say that no, this can't be chance, there must be a grand design behind this. And if you take this applied to postmodernism, which is basically that any phenomena is up for interpretation and up for any kind of grabs, then you have discourses formed. Now, discourses form objects of which they speak, as Michel Foucault once said. So what you have here is you have a discourse of conspiracy theory. And what's interesting about these discourses, and hence the whole postmodern tradition, is that truth and reality aren't outside these discourses. They become formed in the discourses themselves. So this applies again to a wide-ranging phenomena. The word particle in quantum mechanics or quantum physics can be empirically measured, but the word particle doesn't exist outside of the discourse of physics itself. It can be empirically measured, but without being in the discourse of physics itself, no one would know what a particle is. So in that respect, the discourse forms truth and reality in one respect, even though it can be empirically measured, and this is what sets it apart from conspiracy theories. At the same time, however, conspiracy theories have their own established forms of truth present within these discourses, and these are usually tenets and principles such as 9/11, look at this phenomenon, okay, the towers were brought down, why was that? Oh, it was because it was an inside job by the US government, it was a false flag operation. How do you know this? Oh, we've got this evidence that points to this, what evidence is this? That basically the day before the US government knew and they didn't do anything about it. Oh, okay. So that comes into the discourse of conspiracy theory. And at the same time, whilst it's doing this, it's perpetuating its own truth and reality. So conspiracy theories, in terms of social truth, become created in their own discourse. And this is what you see happens between conspiracy theories and people that challenge them, like you and I, is that we're not part of that discourse game. We're outside the discourse. We're the people that try to debunk their discourse. As we're in their discourse, obviously, they're suspicious of us because in that discourse, they've got the truth and the reality down, which is that 9/11 or JFK was an inside job, and it is basically that's the conspiracy theory formed the truth in itself. So that's one essence of how postmodernism, in terms of the creation of truth, reality within a discourse and using evidence and facts to propose an argument, has a massive influence on conspiracy theory. Also, in terms of facts, what you were saying there, I think they kind of have the same understanding of facts as you and I and every other person, but it's just articulated in a more haphazard and unsystematic way, because if you look at the anomalies behind 9/11, they point to all different kinds of facts, such as, like I said, the US government apparently had a warning behind the day before, or why was it that no one was in Tower 7 doing operation checks in terms of sniffer dogs and bombs. These are kind of facts that that can actually be validated. There were no sniffer dogs the week before doing checks on bombs in the building, which is just routine mishap and misfortune. But these kind of anomalies kind of get blown up into kind of conspiratorial explanations. So they do use facts like any other rational thinking person. It's just that they pick and choose what facts they use, and they manipulate them in a different way. And this is one area that's also got a prominent research later, which is rationality and conspiracy theories. And there's a great professor of philosophy in Australia called David Cody, who's been doing work on this, and he's basically been presenting the idea that conspiracy theories are rational, but only inside the discourse of conspiracy theory themselves. And this kind of points to what I'm saying with postmodernism, which is if you're in a discourse of conspiracy theory, you're using the same facts as I am, but we're coming to different conclusions. And to that schema and that state, it makes sense. But outside that discourse, it doesn't make sense. So the issue here is more to do, certainly, since it's obviously postmodernism, which anything's up for grabs, but also to do with the psychology and the schema and the worldview. Because if you're a conspiracy theorist, then you're more likely to understand other events as conspiracy theories. And that's a topic I can talk on a bit later.
Actually, so in that one area, and maybe I used the wrong word with respect, but one of the things that seems to be quite common is, and again, perhaps I'm being a bit full of myself here in saying it this way, but we often say our opinions are based upon facts, that we have the facts, and from that we derive our opinions. And it seems to be almost the reverse for conspiracy. They have their opinions, and onto that they find the facts. It's almost a reversal of the causal chain.
That's one aspect of it. But at the same time, if you look at what they do with facts, it's everyone starts off with some form of social observation, and then we come to a conclusion either way. I'm not necessarily advocating that they start with an opinion and then end up at the facts, which sometimes they do, which is the scheme of conspiracy theory, which I'll talk about a bit later, which is basically if you're predisposed to see the world like this, then you're going to have an opinion first and let the facts flourish. But at the same time, they can start in the opposite direction, which is observing a fact and then coming up to a different conclusion. So if you think about 9/11, one fact is that basically after the first plane went in the building, it took air traffic control, I believe, about an hour or two to scramble fighter planes. And unfortunately, they sent a few of them in the wrong direction because the radar on the plane that went in to the building obviously turned off the radar. And the other plane that had been hijacked, they had turned off the sonar radar and that signal. So literally, air traffic control couldn't find this plane. That's actually a fact. Now, what you do with that fact after is up to you, and that becomes part of the discourse game. Now, I personally believe, as most people probably would, that this is just a genuine mistake there, and it's easy to understand why they couldn't find the plane, because the terrorists had turned off the sonar in there, so it's hard to find a plane. Now, if you're a conspiracy theorist, you take that same fact, and it's part of a meta overarching explanation where, in this world, coincidence and mishaps and accidents don't happen. There is some form of agency out there that's responsible for this. So they take the same fact that we couldn't find these planes on this certain day, and they come to the conclusion that it was deliberately executed to be this way. So it depends on how you take facts and how you use them to come to a conclusion. And to a certain extent, they do use, I believe, the same facts as us, just come to a different convoluted conclusion explanation.
Thank you, Tony, for your time. listeners, we will continue this interview next week when Tony will once again be here in our virtual studio. We will discuss conspiracy theory as political ideology. But now, the commercial.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com. Be a good skeptic and listen to Radio Free Thinkers every Tuesday here on CITR 101.9 FM.
So we're back. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Tony Sobrato. This is only one of three parts we have of this excellent discussion I had with Tony. Next week, we're going to be talking about conservative theory as a political ideology, which was really bizarre. I hadn't thought of it that way. So tune in next week. But now, let's do our skeptic highlights. This week, I have two highlights. One, Change in U.S. Politics. It's by Martin Tobin at the Almer Van Duz Room in the Vancouver Public Library this Wednesday, March 14th at noon. And the write-up for it says, Barack Obama promised change in U.S. politics. He hinted at a more egalitarian, less militaristic society with more social justice. There is a strong argument that not only have the goals not been raised, but they would be impossible to achieve in present-day U.S. society. An analysis will consider the situation by reviewing U.S. political history and U.S. political culture. Now, I don't mean to focus a lot on the U.S., because sometimes I do get a little U.S.-centric. They have so much more exciting news down there than we do. But there has been sort of a trend that whatever's going on in the United States, in about a decade or so, you see start appearing here in Canada. So there is something that we might be able to learn and perhaps nip in the bud before we have the same level of dysfunctional politics they have in the United States. The other highlight I have this week is Good Without God. It's part of the SFU's Philosopher's Cafe. It's going to be March 14th at 7 p.m. at the Bob Pitty Metrotown Library in Burnaby. The moderator, Randall McKinnon, asks if you agree or disagree with Robert Buckman's belief that non-believers can live a good life and ethical life without God. So again, it's a topic that's been covered quite a bit, but should be quite interesting to show up, listen to what's been said, and partake in the discussion that usually happens afterwards. Ethan?
Well, my skeptical highlight, we've mentioned this already, but I'm going to mention it again, that is the Cross Canada Skeptical Smackdown, the Vancouver edition. This is the third annual Cross Canada Skeptical Smackdown, and it's happening Wednesday the 14th, 7:30, at the Billy Bishop Legion in Vancouver. And of course, the Cross Canada Skeptical Smackdown is a fun and challenging British-style pub quiz which focuses on critical thinking and scientific topics. It occurs every year in multiple locations across Canada with local and national bragging rights at stake. It's a really fun evening, so come on out, have a few drinks, and quiz yourself on your knowledge of skeptical pop culture. There's all kinds of interesting conversations that happen. It's a really neat event, and every city that participates always brags and competes with each other about who has the smartest skeptical people in it. I must say that Vancouver is at a huge advantage in this because, let's face it, we are the best skeptical city in Canada.
Ethan, pop quiz. Who's the smartest person in the studio?
Well, I mean, that's pretty obvious, isn't it?
Yes, I think we both agree on that.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I guess we're out of time here on Radio Free Thinker, so remember to tune in next week for our second interview. But in the meantime, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.